You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at WPCouncil.org.
Okay.
Now, troll on in.
And you know, as you know, over the years that we've been doing the show and talking about the council, there are a bunch of branches, if you will. The fishery management councils are nationwide, and we are the biggest one with regards to, geography, because we cover so much of the Pacific. But, you know, we have some things that are in common and some things that are not. And so what you guys and gals are going to learn today is a little bit different from the stuff that we normally do. Josh DeMello, fisheries analyst here in Hawaii, is here to talk today about a get-together that's going on. It is a regional fishery management council meeting. And there are people from I don't know how many of the councils, but it's about partnerships. And I guess maybe seeing some of the similarities and some of the differences. And it must be kind of cool. This one is in Sitka, Alaska, but you don't have to go, right?
No.
Yeah, but are they wearing, I hope they got protective clothing, because it's still a little bit chilly over there, right?
Right. So this is a meeting of the Council Coordination Committee, which is a meeting of all 8 regional fishery management councils across the nation, and it also includes the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Okay, so this is one of the times that everybody gets together, and I guess to compare notes, how often does that meeting happen? When is everybody?
That happens twice a year, once in the Silver Spring, D.C. area, and then once in the spring, summertime, yep, where it's rotated amongst each of the 8 regions.
Okay, so this time it's in Sitka, Alaska. There's going to be a lot of stuff going on. And when it comes together, generally speaking, we know that everybody that doesn't know it, maybe a little primer on what the councils are. And more importantly, because a lot of this is to do with budgets, how they get funded.
So the councils are a result of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act of 1976. And it's been reauthorized a few times since then. Mm-hmm. But the councils are funded by Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the topics that they bring up every time at these CCC meetings, as it's called, is budgets.
Yeah, and who gets what?
And what is the National Marine Fisheries Service budget, and what, mm-hmm, is Congress going to do, mm-hmm, and what kind of funding is available for councils to do, mm-hmm, the work that Magnuson says?
So obviously there would be some friendly competition between the different regions for who gets what?
Usually, but I think that, yeah, that was settled probably a long time ago, mm-hmm, before I even yeah, got on board.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they have their percentages that they've battled for and worked out, mm-hmm, and eventually is provided to each of the councils.
So when you say that this is a meeting about budgets, obviously, you know, in the big picture, all government is tethered to fiscal years, financial years, election years, and all kinds of stuff. So obviously, they must be talking about budgets and funding that are going to happen at some point down the road, not immediately.
Right. So usually the first meeting, they talk about budget because that's right before the budget comes out, or it's supposed to come out every year.
Yeah, right.
So they meet in around February, and then the budget comes out March, April. But this one that's coming up in next week, they're really talking about what's going to be going on in the future, mm-hmm, as far as budgets and what the landscape looks like given the presidency and the administration's
right, state of the economy, a lot of things, right, too, right?
Yeah, yeah. What they are prioritizing, mm-hmm, for fisheries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, one of the things that we knew, that there's some changes going to happen within the protected areas, the monument areas, and that kind of stuff. That's one thing. But I think that in the whole thing looked like to me when you gave me the materials, it starts out with the National Marine Fisheries Service doing an update. What is the core mission, or what is the core reason why that body exists? Who are they?
The National Marine Fisheries Service is one of the line offices of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So it's under the blanket NOAA.
And then under that, above that is the Department of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
So the Department of Commerce is part of the president's cabinet that helps to run the country. And so under commerce, you're usually talking about, mm-hmm, money,
mm-hmm,
and businesses.
And so what the National Marine Service, Fisheries Service is doing is explaining the value or the import of fisheries to the country.
Right. And a lot of people see that as commercial fishing.
Yeah.
But you also have a lot of value in recreational fishing and non-commercial fishing.
Now, and the value in that, my friends, is what we often talk about, not just on this segment, but in other times. Because what you're talking about is everybody from recreational guides, catch and release, equipment, service industries. There's a whole bunch of people. We're not just talking about the value of fish. We're talking about the fishery.
Which goes up from hundreds of millions to billions of dollars.
Yeah, unbelievable. So obviously, they're sometimes the bearer of good news or the bearer of bad news. I would imagine with unemployment being at an all-time low and the economy seemed to be bustling around right now, they would be looking for some robust activity, financial activity.
And one of the Secretary of Commerce's main speech points that he makes at pretty much every speech I've heard him talk at is he wants to reduce the seafood trade deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that we import nationally 90% of our seafood.
Right.
And so
and he wants it to be the other way around, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, he wants to at least bring it down to 50, 40, 30, maybe even down to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we get there? The only way we can remove that deficit is to start producing more. And fisheries and aquaculture, those are the ways that we're going to get to.
Okay, there's a lot of people saying that just by increasing the catch, you can reduce that number. But then there would be any bunch of naysayers saying, but you have to agree on not increasing the catch in certain areas because certain species are either endangered or certainly at risk.
And that's where the councils come in, mm-hmm. because the councils are managing it so that those fish populations are sustainable, mm-hmm. and that people can keep fishing for it.
Yeah.
I think the big thing for this meeting is finding out what the National Marine Fisheries Service and NOAA and the Department of Commerce, mm-hmm. what are their plans and how do we get there using the system we already have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wouldn't one of those systems be the method of stock assessments, the science of stock assessments? Because we've recently found out in our district that sometimes we had underrated the strength of certain species, that we have a little bit more fish than we might have thought we had, which would be good news for fishermen, right?
And it all comes back to data.
Yeah.
Also, one of the things on the agenda is to talk about recreational fishing and then the Recreational Fishing Summit that we came and talked about a couple of weeks back. And so when you have data available, you can create better stock assessments that are more trustworthy and produce a number that is more akin to what the fishermen are seeing on the water.
Sometimes you feel in Hawaii that we're in a rock and a hard place because a lot of people don't want licensing, don't want to be included in surveys or calculated. But in actual fact, a lot of the states on the mainland, maybe they don't fish the same as we do, but they're much more accurate because we know how many there are because they have to have licenses. There are consequences. If you get pulled over on the side of the road or the creek in many states and you don't have a license, you're going to get arrested. I mean, they're that adamant about being able to quantify and collectively identify who's fishing and what they're catching.
And I think it goes back to historically they've gotten licenses for everything before, why not that? But in Hawaii, really, it's more of our asserting our rights to be able to fish.
Mm-hmm.
But then we always talk about it's not just a right, but it's a privilege to fish.
you need to take
some responsibility on it.
Well, there are many that say that some of the very problems that these things bring up are also sometimes detrimental. We already know that there's been, like, for instance, it's totally unrelated, but there's always a move underfoot to legalize recreational marijuana use because of the revenue that it would bring in for the government. In other words, it's going on anyway, so why don't we get our share? The opposite is true in the fishery. Isn't most people thinking when the fishery gets threatened by when you see people coming in with boatloads of stuff that don't seem to get unreported, that's a finite amount of stuff that it is hard to repair one of these things if you let it get as low as some of them got.
Right.
With
marijuana, you can go and grow
some
more.
It's
not that it's easy, but it's not hard either compared to fishing, where once you take that fish, it takes generations to get a fish back up growing and reproducing.
But there is, and I know the two areas have got to cross paths all the time. There's ever more evidence saying that, all right, we can't keep expecting the ocean to yield everything that we need. We have to grow fish somewhere. whether it's inland, in the middle of the country, raising ahi in Nebraska, or aquaculture, or other things, that we just absolutely have to be more scientific and more embracing of that technology. Because a lot of people don't like it. They don't want, look what happened here in Oahu. They don't want a big fish pen outside Waianae. Now they do.
And I think to reduce that fish or seafood deficit, that you're really going to have to depend on aquaculture.
Yeah.
And one of the things they're going to talk about at this meeting is offshore aquaculture and what it means and how it's going nationally. Right now in the Gulf of Mexico, they have a fishery management plan that they've been working on for 15 years to get passed, and it's still waiting the final approval so people can get permits. Out here, we actually have aquaculture happening offshore, off of Kona. We've had it off of Eva Beach, and so there is a precedent for the state to do it. But we're also working at the council to develop our own plan so that if anyone wants to go outside of 3 miles, it's managed in the proper way.
It also is sort of interesting to me. Is there have been fish pens around for a long time. And what they were feeding them came under question. You know, maybe they're introducing a meal or bran or, you know, grains or something instead of what the fish normally eat. But I think most of that has been addressed with the way that they have the collection facilities, whether it's a net or a fence or a bag or a bin or a trap. What they feed them has also been measured. And from what I understand, sometimes around these areas that they were worried about, you know, the effluent and all of that stuff, it seems to not be an issue. I don't know.
I think around Hawaii, it makes a good test case because the waters are deeper, closer to shore, compared to someplace like Puget Sound or, you know, those net pens that go on in these areas that are really protected and the water doesn't move as much as it
Yeah, that's it does. A good point. Yeah, stuff would have a tendency to settle there, right?
But there's also the benefits of it acting like a giant fish aggregation device or FAD so that people can go fish around it and you're catching fish. That's what the guys in Kona have been telling us.
You know, we've just been through and are still in the middle of this big eruption. And we're worried about volcanic ash and we're worried about gases and we're worried about all kinds of stuff. And it really has our attention, right? And yet some of these things, they seem to be, you know, over-worried. There's more people that say, for instance, isn't a great deal of what we import, why the balance is shellfish. It's particularly like shrimp. You know, there's shrimp coming in from Asia and from places that who knows how they're grown. You know, isn't that a concern too?
Well, you can probably go online and look at the conditions of those cages.
Yeah.
But a lot of those fish... A lot of those shrimp stocks that are raised in Southeast Asia have its roots in Hawaii with the Oceanic Institute creating seed stock and selling it to them. Mm. And after a few generations, they all have genetic links back to to Hawaii.
Yeah, we sold them the stuff, and now we're paying for it.
Right, and you know why can't we do it here? If they can, they have larger land, cheaper labor, and everything, but. That cost can be figured out.
We have learned that there are some people that are getting closer on some species to be able to really grow them. I do know that some of the high-demand fish are the hardest to grow. You know, the pelagics, they're the hardest to keep somewhere. Like, growing mahi-mahi doesn't seem to work yet. I know it probably will someday in a bigger number, but right now it kind of doesn't. Same thing with some of the tunas. There are some people that are saying, we're going to be able to raise them. It's just a matter of time.
I think the biggest problem for pelagic species is that they just eat a lot of food.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're spending a lot of money to raise something like tuna or mahi when you can go out and catch it for a lot cheaper than what you've spent.
Very good point. However, there's a line at which if you catch too much, it's going to begin going in the wrong direction. I don't see many of the pelagics being affected. I mean, a lot of times some would say, well, you know, and there's another misunderstanding. We got to back up here a minute. Those of you know that me and Josh have been talking about this, the council sponsors part of the program every week. The council is not a branch of the longline fishing industry. As a matter of fact, a lot of people think that's the case. And in actual fact, they get treated, the longline fleet just gets treated just like everybody else, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, but we're highly looked at here. And because it's the council and because of other things, we are maybe, like you said, we set the mark for some of this stuff. We gave them the shrimp, and now we're giving them safe ways to catch and maintain their catches. So how much of that is going to come up in the meeting where we get recognized for the way our fishery is monitored?
I think in these meetings, one of the things that we always try to do is show that we're not far behind. Just because we're not connected to the mainland physically doesn't mean we're not doing the same things or even ahead of the game in a lot of cases.
What one thing I got, Josh, that everybody gets a kick out of whenever I do this type of show with you guys, is that we have this huge landmass, but our value, our fish values, there's some places that are way smaller than us that have bigger values. So it must, you know what I'm getting at? There's like some of the other branches, their landmass or ocean mass is a lot smaller, but the catch or their volume is a lot higher.
Right. And so Hawaii has a small fishery relative to the rest of the United States. And that's probably one of the reasons why you see longlining always the big deal with our consul,
because that's where we get our fish.
That's our main fishery, and we have a longline fishery in American Samoa as well. And now our bottom fish fishery is taking more precedence in some cases. But what you're going to see is that Hawaii, while we have that small fishery, we actually have large value because we catch big eye tuna, which is a high value fish.
Yeah, and we're working with a fresh fish, not a processed fish most of the time.
And 80% of it stays in Hawaii. Yeah, so that value is added to the Hawaii economy, at least 80% of it.
Now, when you mentioned earlier, and this is, I think people are going to get, this is what the takeaway from this section of our program, our Go Fish program, is all about. And by the way, if you want to hear something on the consul segment, the best thing that you can do is go take a look at the consul website. Some great work is being done there. It's very user-friendly. It's a wealth of information. It's wpconsul.org, wpconsul.org, particularly if you got school-agers in your family, somebody looking for a project or something you want to write on. It's a great source. There's materials that are free that you can get. If you're a teacher and you want to have some fun in your classroom, the consul provides some great learning aids. But I think that in the final analysis, people are surprised at how much fish we import in Hawaii. You think we're in the ocean, we can catch more fish than anybody else. It turns out that we import probably more than anybody else because we all want to eat it.
I think Hawaii is probably 60-70% imports. It's a lot lower than the rest of the United States, even though our consumption of fish is
higher,
way higher per capita than
the rest of the United States. Well, it's pretty easy to see, though. I mean, the pelagics, the really tasty gourmet fish that we're talking about are really not found inland. So, I mean, you know, if they want it, they got to bring it in. Whereas we, on the other hand, aren't we slow to adapt and say, we'll eat haddock or cod or some of the fish that aren't you know, readily available in our markets. We want a local fish.
Right. And there's actually the main, I guess, issue is that we have the price point that needs to be met. Because not everyone can afford grade A sashimi all the time. So
that's a great point. Not all the time, but not much of the time, you know.
So there's room in the market for a cheaper fish, and you see that at some of these stores where you have the carbon monoxide treated tunas.
Yep.
And that's why you always wonder, why is that one so cheap? And then you go to somewhere like Fresh Catch, and it's like $18, $19, $20 a pound for poke.
Take a look. There's another thing, and I don't know if this is going to come up in the meeting or not, but I don't know any fad that has grown faster than poke bowls. You know, I mean, right now, 5 years ago, there were some poke bowls. Yeah, you get the idea. Now, I mean, there are people that have poke bowls that don't even have any other kind of fish. They just have this thing called the poke bowl. They actually call them poke bowls because they're so in demand right now. It's so trendy.
There's, I think, three places around our office alone. And then you can get it at pretty much every fish market now.
Yeah, everywhere.
Even in American Samoa, one of the places in American Samoa has started.
One of these days on the program, I'm going to have a little contest for you guys to send in some stuff. And we're organizing some great prizes. And we're gonna talk about that. And by the way, if you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. You drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com, or go to wpconsul.org and tell them that you want to see something. But I think getting back to these meetings is important because whenever we send people away to represent us, you know, we know we're sending the best of the best. We got a good delegation going over there. But what is I looked at the agenda and I'm trying to think, okay, well, where's the infighting going to come from? Where's the jealousy? And it doesn't look like there is any. It looks like this is more, like you said, Ernie, a way that we can collaborate and partner up with each other. Maybe we're going to learn stuff about some of the fisheries that we are not familiar with, and they're going to learn plenty of stuff about us in Sitka.
So I think a lot of the things that they'll talk about in Sitka is how do we come to consensus on certain points, things like legislation. Where do we stand on Magnuson reauthorization bill or an aquaculture bill or coral reef bill? Where does the council or all of the councils as a whole, what can they all agree with? And then what are our regional perspectives saying, well, while we agree with this, there's also this other thing.
Well, there's a learning curve, right? There's a learning curve that you're expected to, that we're expected to learn and they're expected to learn. One of the things that I know that, and I love it, and I know my audience does, is when we start talking about technology, and I noticed one of the things on one of the days is electronic monitoring. We already know that right now we have the longline fleet, especially the swordfish guys, they're like monitored with a person all the time. But aren't we getting a lot closer to be able to not only know where a boat is that should or shouldn't be fishing somewhere, but kind of what they're doing and what they're catching?
And the point of that topic is to learn what the best practices are and what's going on and who's going to support electronic monitoring, because it's not just the observers that are on the boat. It's not just where they are. Yeah. It's also, what are they catching? Can we get that data in real time? And how do we do that? Do we do that through a smartphone app or on a tablet that sends it through the satellite back to Honolulu?
That's the thing, gang. You'll be amazed. I was in the POP offices the other day and looking at where their boats were. And they have these monitors. You can track within a few yards in the ocean, you know where they are. In other words, forget turning left when you're supposed to turn right, brother. You better turn left because we know where you are. But isn't that also the truth because of technology? Now when a guy's working on a longline boat, say he's in the sword fishery as an observer, he can get his work on a daily basis up in the sky and to his office like in minutes.
Yeah, and one of the problems is that who's going to pay for the that use? Because uploading to a satellite is not cheap. not super expensive, but it's not cheap either. And if it's being required by the National Marine Fisheries Service, shouldn't they pay for it?
I was going to say, if you need it so quickly, here it is, come and buy it. You know, send us the money, we'll send you the info.
And it's different per region, because some regions are really rich, and they can afford for their fishermen to pay for it, somewhere like in the Northern Atlantic area. But places like Hawaii, where the cost of doing business is already super high, you're going to add another cost of doing the business just because the federal government's asking you for your information quicker?
We learned a couple of shows ago. You know, I've been fortunate to have the guys from Wicked Tuna on the show from time to time. And we're watching them unload the fish and getting the cost and seeing the fight and seeing the you know, reality type interplay there is. But what we learned, we saw one guy filling up. And the price they pay for fuel is like $2 a gallon less than us.
Right.
And so you think, wait a minute. We're competing with that fish. How can you compete with a fish that costs a third or two-thirds as much to go catch as what ours are? You can't.
And so our longline industry, just to go out on a trip, you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars.
Sure.
Before you even leave the dock.
Before you catch the first fish, most of these boats have put in anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 up front. And by the way, it's just the nature of the beast. Most of them are not operating on credit. Most of them have to pay as they play. You don't get people because every now and again, you can't lose money, but you also have to get paid. So isn't the longline fisherman, the weather's getting bad, sorry, I got to go anyway. I've spent all this money, I got to go fish.
That's just like our small boat fishermen here, our bottom fish fishermen, our trollers. You're going to spend hundreds of dollars on gas and ice and everything else. So you got to pay your crew. Before you even leave the island, you're already in debt. So. Yeah. Fishing is
that's why I got to get a kick of this, because of all of the thousands of people we run through the United Fishing Agency auction over the years, they think, wow, these guys are getting so much money for this fish. When you think about it, wait a minute. There's a bin out on the back, the fish that didn't make it because they spoiled in they got crushed or something happened. The weather got bad for 2 days during this last trip, so we couldn't put the lines out. And we started running low on fuel and ice, so we had to come home. Not every trip is a home run.
And every hook doesn't catch a fish either.
Oh, that's the other thing. Wow, you guys set 2,000 hooks. Yeah, but what if you catch 6 or 8 fish? That's a good lay. Good set.
Right, right. And I'm not saying that they don't make money, because why would they be in it if they're not making any money? But it's not Alaska's king crab fishery where everybody's making $10,000 every trip. Yeah. And yet, right, and people are coming home rich.
However, you must also weigh the odds. If you are fishing around the Hawaiian Islands and fall in the water, you get wet. If you're up there fishing for those crab and you fall in the water, you get dead. I mean, you know, that's a spooky thing, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Oh, it's worth what they get paid, because I know I wouldn't want to be on that boat and getting knocked around and falling off.
When they're taking up, they call them the pots, right? The crab pots. When they throw that hook, that guy's got to be pretty good. The boat's rocking and rolling. You throw the hook, you're going to catch this line. You're going to drag the thing in there, and then it comes over. I mean, I'm telling you, even being in the wheelhouse and watching that stuff is spooky.
Those guys get paid what they deserve to get paid.
Okay, so anyway, and by the way, you're only as good as the last trip you run, right? These skippers, they live and die by their marks, by where they go. Sometimes you go out to where you caught a million crabs, you put your pots down there, you go back and pick them up, there's nothing in them.
Right.
You know? So now that particular fish, isn't that fleet supplying that particular seafood to the entire country? I mean, there aren't other fisheries catch those fish, those crabs.
Right. We don't have king crabs crawling off Oahu.
No,
so
we
that
sure
king
would.
Crab
we
that you're it. Getting at the buffet, comes from somewhere up north.
Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of neat. And one thing that is really neat is, don't you see the interplay between the different regions? They know how big the crabs are and what the keepers are and what the throwbacks are. They're pretty religious about it, too.
And it's all about sharing that type of information and best practices that we can learn from them, and they can learn from us.
Okay, so anyway, and not to compare us with reality shows, we don't have too many of them here, but we should. Maybe that'll be a hint. Some of you TV producers out there, get a reality show together on our guys. All right, well, we talked a little bit about the electronic monitoring before and why it should be done, but what are some of the other things that you think are important that are coming up in this meeting where our delegation is going to be able to bring back victories or knowledge?
So one of the things that I've learned from attending these meetings when they've been here is that one of the most valuable things that you can get out of these meetings is that collaboration with your counterparts in the other parts of the country. So one of the things they're going to talk about is the communications aspect. Mm-hmm. What do other regions do for communications? So when we go, we'll share that we go on the Go Fish show AM 690 and we talk, and we also do other things in some of the other island areas. But what do they do? What can we do that they're doing? So one of the things that I did learn from one of the other meetings is that they do provide this fishing 101 or training type of workshop for fishermen to know what's going on in fisheries, but also where it came from. What are the laws that you actually have to know and how things work?
I've even seen things like, and you can do this at the WP Council website, how to make a business plan, how to decide how to invest in the fishery, how to decide what you want to do, how to look for what you're going to be up against, more than just can I go catch the fish or not. One of the things that you're talking about is being able to compare regions because of electronics and the web now. The more, like our website is to be, I would guess, envied by others, because we have a really good council website. It's everything has room for improvement, but isn't it neat to be able to go to somebody else's and drag down information that you could use today for a speech tomorrow?
So some of those programs that they have on their website, like a calendar function is a lot better than ours. And we'll ask them how do they did it, what software do they use, and then there's other things like a thermometer of where they are with a fishing issue. And there's a lot of things that we like on other people's websites that we want to try and emulate here.
What would be maybe some of the anticipated or expected takeaways? Everybody wants, you don't want just a bag of parting gifts when you walk out of this thing and samples. You want to be able to say, okay, we made our point, or we learned some stuff. What are some of the things that you think might be of value for us to discuss after this meeting in later this month?
So usually when the CCC meeting concludes, it ends up with a letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service or maybe the President of the United States stating a position on one of the issues.
Yeah.
Something that all of the regions can agree on by consensus and everyone contributes.
What I like about it, Josh, I think this is really important for people to understand, is that those letters that you're talking about typically go on to explain who this group is and how many people they represent. In other words, when you ask the president or anybody for anything, if it's three people asking or if it's 30,000 people asking, it gets looked at in a different way.
And especially if it's something that you're supposed to be an expert on, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If it's fisheries coming from the fishery management councils, it's probably a good letter to pay attention to.
Yeah, I would much rather see something that's coming from a place of experience rather than just optimism. In other words, saying yes or no. For instance, I know that the Trump administration has taken a hard look at, because of the president's wanting to deregulate certain things, some things that may be overdoing it. But there are certain adjustments that are going to be made to certain things in the fishery, which I would imagine are going to come up at this meeting and people are going to be happy about. But say, you know, we got somebody that wants to that can understand a little bit that we need to fish.
And that's no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, all about getting the job done and being able to fish forever, as we like to say.
And you know, by the way, the other day, the last time we talked to Uncle Roy Morioka, who just was so instrumental this year in getting a bunch of stuff done and not done at the legislature, because we just, not enough of us reacted to some of the things we should have. They'll be the first to tell you, if you are diametrically opposed to somebody, but they're an expert, you at least have a common ground to say, okay, let's put our Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, whatever stuff on the side of the table. Let's just talk about the fish.
Yeah, and one of the things for legislation always is you got to have somebody that's going to be pushing for it all the time.
Yeah.
And while Uncle Roy is really good pushing for the fishermen, who's behind him at those meetings? There's only a few guys.
Yeah.
And then who's his champion in the legislature or in Congress or wherever? Who's going to take the ball and run with it for you?
And that's really true. And in the case of Roy and others, for instance, sometimes they'll be doing a lot of work with somebody whose political game takes them somewhere else. They've been doing this for a long time. They got a good reputation because they bring back to the Senate or the House or the administration the fishermen's cares and concerns. But now they've taken a job in the private sector. So all of those years of relationships, you got to start at ground zero again.
Yeah, and especially in election years this year, it's shaking up.
Okay, are you optimistic? For instance, I do know that we have a kindred relationship for sure with Alaska. You know, I mean, we're the 49th and the 50th states. We've got a lot of things in common. There's a lot of interchange, believe it or not, in our fishermen and some of our people that fish in both places. But how do we reach across and say, talk outside of the Wicked Tuna guys? How do we talk to the East Coast? How do we talk to Florida? How do we talk to, you know, Louisiana and Texas and California?
And that's one of the big issues. Us in the Pacific, we all share the same fish. So
pretty much.
So we're really on the same page a lot of the times. And then when you look at other things going on, you got the East Coast, the North Atlantic, the Mid-Atlantic, South Atlantic, and even the Gulf.
Yeah.
They're really different. They're really supported by their
really
congressmen, and they're really They have bigger fisheries and they have more people with more influence. And so how do we get to that point? And it's a little more difficult because we are just a bunch of islands out in the middle of the Pacific.
Well, I mean, Mark Twain said this string of pearls out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, right? And we want to say we're different, but we are different. You know, we're a little bit different. As a matter of fact, we've always got people that are coming over here that go on charter boats. And they just expected that at the end of the day, they're going to walk off there with their mai-mai on their shoulder.
And like Uncle Roy said when he was a council chairman, is we don't want more. We want different.
Yeah.
So we're not asking for the world. We're asking to be treated as unique as we are and allowing us to do things our way, the island way.
Yeah, and that's a great way to put it, Josh. I want to thank you again for shedding some light on this. And hopefully we get together after this thing. I know it's in the last week of May, right? It's coming right up this coming week.
Yes.
And so we'll talk about this. Was it expected? Maybe some really good things happened. And remember, if you want to hear something on the program, it is pretty easy. You can drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. I see a lot of you getting ready for the Ahi Fever, the Ahi Shoot, I should say. Thanks to Victor Lozano and Gary from the Lure Company. We'll be back with more GoFish next time. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Have a great day fishing, and leave some for me. See you next time.